Follow me.
And led her down a long, cheerless corridor. At the end was a numberless white door.
This do for ya?
There was a single bed made up with cheap polyester sheets, floral curtains, and a coffee-colored carpet splattered with miscellaneous stains. In the far corner, a tiny television was nailed to the wall. Next to it, the door to the luxury individual bathroom stood open, revealing a luxury individual toilet with no seat or lid, and a luxury individual shower with mold growing between the tiles.
This is fine. How much do I owe you?
How long you staying?
I'm not sure.
Suddenly conscious of her disheveled appearance and the fact that she had no luggage with her, Grace blurted out,
I had a fight with my boyfriend. I left in kind of a hurry.
Yoda shrugged, bored.
$20 for tonight.
Grace pressed a bill into his hand and he left. Locking the door behind him, Grace drew the curtains closed. She took off all her clothes and walked into the bathroom. Only then did she sink to her knees, lean over the toilet, and vomit. When her stomach was empty, she stood up and stepped into the shower. Under the weak, lukewarm jets of water, she scrubbed at herself with a used bar of soap until her skin bled. She could still feel the man's filthy hands on her breasts, his revolting rapist seed on her face, in her mouth. There'd been 2 bottles of drinking water in the back of the van that she'd used to clean herself up as best she could a few hours ago, so as not to arouse suspicion. On the long walk here, she had forced herself to focus on the shower awaiting her, on being clean. But she knew now she would never be clean again. Drying herself off, she retched again, but there was nothing left inside her to throw up. She moved into the bedroom and sank down on the bed. It was warm in the room. Leaning back against the cheap foam pillow, Grace flicked on the TV. Her own face stared back at her. Or rather, her face as it had once been, long, long ago.
So it's public already. At least they're using an old picture. I'll have to do something about a disguise first thing in the morning before they release a new one.
The newscaster was talking.
In breaking news, Grace Brookstein is reported to have absconded from a maximum security correctional facility in upstate New York. Brookstein, widow of the billionaire con man Leonard Brookstein.
The report went on, but Grace didn't hear it. She felt more tired than she could ever remember. It had been the longest 24 hours of her life. Sleep caressed her like the softest of cashmere blankets. She closed her eyes and let it take her.
Gavin Williams was screaming, Are you blind? This is it! The breakthrough we've been praying for! Grace will lead us straight to the money!
Gavin Williams, Harry Bain, and John Merrivale were having a working breakfast at Quorum's old offices. It was the morning after Grace's escape, and the news was all over the TV and newspapers. Harry Bain shook his head.
I doubt that. Even assuming she knows where it is. She knows where it is. Even if she does, she won't get that far. She's got the entire NYPD looking for her. My guess is she'll be back behind bars by nightfall. Either that, or some trigger-happy cop will have shot her.
No,
We can't let that happen.
It was unlike Williams to lose control, but he looked close to tears.
Grace Brookstein remains the key to this case. We must take control. We must insist the NYPD hand the investigation over to the Bureau.
Harry Bain laughed.
Oh, yeah. I'll insist. I'm sure the chief of police will love that.
Gavin Williams looked to John Merrill for support. But, of course, John just stared at his shoes like the coward that he was. Furious, Williams got up and stormed out. Merrill said,
I know it's not my place to say so, but I think perhaps the stress of this case is becoming too much for Agent Williams.
Harry Bain agreed.
You're right. I'm having him transferred. Grace Brookstein has become an obsession. It's clouding his judgment. Her escape is a distraction, and we can't afford distractions.
Exactly.
John Merrill breathed a sigh of relief. He wouldn't rest completely easily until Grace was captured, or better yet, shot. News of her escape had shaken him deeply, but today's meeting was reassuring. With Gavin Williams out of the picture, it would be even easier to lead Bain and his men in the wrong direction. Eventually, they'd run out of energy or money or both and call off the investigation. Then finally, he would be free. Free to leave New York, to leave Caroline. A life without chains. In the end, it would all be worth it.
Do you really think they'll find her quickly?
Harry Bain said,
I'm sure of it. She's Grace Brookstein, for God's sake. Where is she gonna hide?
In her dreams, Grace heard knocking, faint but rapid and insistent like a woodpecker in the distance. The noise grew louder, closer. She woke up.
There's someone at the door.
Jumping out of bed, she grabbed her switchblade and wrapped the bedsheet around her, stumbling towards the sound in the darkness.
Who is it?
It's me.
Yoda.
Grace put down the knife and opened the door a crack.
You staying another night?
The light from the corridor was blinding. Grace blinked.
I'm sorry?
I said, you staying another night? It's noon. Changeover's 12:30. You ain't staying, you gotta vacate the room by then.
Oh. No, I'm staying.
$20.
Grace pulled out a second bill out of the wad Karen had given her and handed it to the old man. He took it wordlessly, scuttling back to his reception desk like a decrepit beetle.
12 o'clock? Jesus, I must have been out like a light.
Grace opened the curtains, then closed them again. Far too bright. Splashing cold water on her face, she pulled on her clothes. They stank of that bastard, but they were all she had. She would buy new ones today. The TV was still on from last night. Grace turned up the volume. This time, the news report was on the economy. But a few moments later, her face was back on screen again. This time, a mugshot from the day they brought her back to Bedford.
It still looks nothing like me.
The anchor woman was talking.
With Grace Brookstein now missing for over 17 hours, the police appear to have no concrete leads. With me is Detective Mitchell Connors of the NYPD, the man leading the investigation into Brookstein's escape. Detective, people are already saying that you and your men are running out of ideas. Do you feel that's a fair statement? An attractive blonde cop responded by video link.
No, Nancy, I don't believe it is. We're pursuing a number of different avenues. This investigation is only hours old. It's our belief that the prisoner will be apprehended swiftly, and we're working towards that conclusion.
Grace studied the cop's face.
Detective Mitchell Connors looked like he had been sketched by a cartoonist at Marvel Comics. All square jaw and steady, blue-eyed gaze. Physically, he reminded Grace of a rougher-around-the-edges version of her brother-in-law, Jack Warner. But his expression was nothing like Jack's. If anything, it was more like Lenny's.
It's his eyes. He has kind eyes.
He was still talking.
Grace Brookstein and her husband brought extraordinary suffering to thousands of people, particularly here in New York. Believe me, Nancy, no one wants to see this convicted felon back behind bars more than I do. Make no mistake, we will find her.
Grace switched off the television.
Detective Connors might have kind eyes, but he's my enemy.
She mustn't forget it.
That afternoon, Grace walked into town. It was all she could do to stop her teeth from chattering, knowing that her face was all over the news, that at any moment someone might recognize her and turn her into the authorities. But she couldn't hide out at the motel forever. She needed supplies, and she needed to get out of Richardsville. Karen and Cora had both warned her of the dangers of staying in one place too long. With the van driver's bulky jacket pulled tightly around her, Grace kept her head down as she walked the aisles of Walmart. At the checkout, her heart was pounding so violently she thought she might faint. Happily, the sullen teenager manning the register seemed more interested in the chip on one of her acrylic nails than in the nervous customer or her purchases.
$88 your total, cash or credit?
Cash.
Thanks, have a nice day.
The girl didn't even look up.
By the time Grace returned to her room at the Up All Night, it was almost 4 p.m. Locking the door, she emptied her Walmart bags onto the bed. Hair dye, scissors, makeup, disinfectant, underwear, a 3-pack of Hanes t-shirts, jeans, a beanie hat, and a gray carry-all gym bag. She got to work. The old man at the reception desk studied the picture in his newspaper. His eyes weren't what they used to be.
Could it be? This girl's nose was different, and the hair. Still, there was definitely a resemblance. And she had arrived in the middle of the night with no suitcase. He looked at the paper again. The cop on the TV said to report anything suspicious, no matter how trivial. The old man picked up the phone.
Grace looked at herself in the cracked bathroom mirror. Except it wasn't herself. It was someone else, the first of her four new identities.
Lizzie Woolley. Hello, Lizzie.
Carefully cleaning up all traces of dye and picking up every lock of severed hair off the floor, Grace dropped them into the empty Walmart bag along with the discarded bottle of Nice and Easy and her old clothes, tied the bag by the handles, and stuffed it into her carry-all. She dressed quickly. The clean clothes felt wonderful. For a moment, Grace thought back to her old life and smiled. She could never have imagined back then the day would come when a pair of Walmart jeans would feel like the last word in luxury. She'd already spent 2/3 of the cash Karen and Cora had given her. Pretty soon, she would have to make email contact with Karen's mysterious friend and ask for more. Cora had assured her that getting cash from Western Union was anonymous and easy. All you had to do was show up at one of their hundreds of thousands of locations, show your fake ID, and take the money.
It's how every illegal immigrant in this country makes rent, honey. It's their business not to ask questions.
Even so, Grace hoped she wouldn't have to do it too often. She checked the bus timetable earlier. The next bus to the city left at 6:15 p.m. Plenty of time. The old man knocked on the door. No answer. Officer McKinley, Richardsville's finest, Richardsville's only, looked pissed.
I thought you said she was definitely here.
Officer McKinley knew the minute old man Murdoch called that it'd be some stupid-ass wild goose chase. Grace Brookstein staying at the Up all night? Yeah, right. She was probably sharing a room with Kermit the Frog and Herman Munster. Everyone in Richardsville knew that Murdoch had lost his marbles years ago.
She's here, all right? Saw her come in with my own two eyes, and she ain't come out again. Must be sleeping.
Unhooking the master key from his belt loop, the old man unlocked the door.
Miss?
The room was empty. Not just empty, but pristine. The bed was made, the surfaces wiped clean. It looked as if no one had stayed in there in weeks. Officer McKinley rolled his eyes.
She was here, I tell ya. Last two nights, I swear to God, must have escaped out the window.
Uh-huh.
On a flying monkey.
Well,
if you see her again, you be sure and let us know. Chapter 17. Maria Preston floated into the 6th-floor Caprice restaurant in Hong Kong's Four Seasons Hotel. In a chiffon caftan, dripping in newly bought pearls from the Guangzhou City Jewelry District, she waved the newspaper excitedly at her husband.
Have you seen this, Andy?
Seen what, my love?
Grace Brookstein's escaped from prison.
Andrew Preston went white.
Escaped? What do you mean she's escaped? That's not possible.
Snatching the paper, he read the front page story. A major police operation was underway last night in New York after convicted con artist Grace Brookstein apparently broke out of a maximum security facility in Westchester County. Brookstein, one of the most notorious women in America, is believed to have stolen upward of $70 billion in a conspiracy masterminded by her late husband, Leonard.
Can you believe it?
Maria giggled as she poured herself a large glass of fresh orange juice.
Escaped from jail? It's like something out of Desperate Housewives. Next thing you know, she'll wake up in the shower with amnesia, and the last 20 years will have never happened. Do you think they'll catch her?
Andrew was too stunned to speak. This was a disaster, a catastrophe. Just when he thought the whole nightmare was behind him, Grace had to pull a stunt like this and reopen old wounds. Maria seemed to think it was some sort of joke. But then, why wouldn't she? She had no idea of the stress he'd been under. As long as she had money to spend, this trip to Hong Kong alone had cost over $40,000, not including the astronomical sums Maria had saved on pearl jewelry. She was happy. What was it to her if Andrew hadn't slept properly in over a year? If he lay in their bed in the $12,000 a night presidential suite overlooking Victoria Harbor and Kowloon Bay, bent double with stomach cramps and crippling migraines, haunted by nightmares involving Lenny Brookstein and the scarred, terrifying face of a man named Donald Anthony LeBron. Had it not been for Maria, he would have never done what he did. Never have betrayed a friend. Never have become a thief. Never have had cause to associate with the likes of LeBron. And yet, he couldn't tell her. He just couldn't. Most distressing of all was the alopecia. Since last Christmas, Andrew's hair had started falling out in clumps, like a dog with mange. He panicked.
I'm falling to pieces. Literally. It's the beginning of the end.
Thank God it was John Merrivale who had to deal with the FBI day in, day out, and not him. The stress would have finished him off. Andrew could hear John's voice in his head now, repeating the mantra,
"Just stick to the story and you'll be fine. We both will."
So far, they had. But Grace's escape could change everything.
"Andy, are you listening to me? I said, do you think they'll catch her?"
"Yes, I'm sure they'll catch her."
"They have to."
"What will happen to her then, do you think?"
"I don't know. They'll take her back to jail, I suppose."
Andrew thought about Grace Brookstein, the sweet, naive child he'd known for all those years. Poor Grace. She was the only truly innocent victim in all of this. Unfortunately, that was what happened to pure little lambs. They got slaughtered. Maria sipped her orange juice contentedly.
"Don't look so miserable, Andy. Anyone would think it was you the police were after. Now give me back the newspaper, would you? There's a gorgeous Balenciaga dress in the fashion pages. I'm thinking of having it copied."
Jack Warner saw the news on television. He was in a bar with Fred Farrell, his campaign manager, discussing his re-election strategy. When he saw Grace's face on the TV screen, he choked on his pistachios.
"Holy Mother of God! Can you believe this?"
Fred Farrell couldn't. People didn't break out of places like Bedford Hills. Not in real life. Especially not petite, blonde, trophy wives like Grace Brookstein.
"You'll have to make a statement."
Fred Farrell's brilliant political mind was already whirring. This was not a good time for the quorum scandal to come back and haunt them. Grace would probably be caught within a few hours, but the renewed media interest in the Brookstein case could last for months. Jack must not be dragged into it.
"I'll write you something. In the meantime, go home and lay low."
Jack Warner went home. During the hour-long drive to Westchester, he composed his thoughts. Fred Farrell didn't know the half of it. He knew about the gambling debts and Lenny Brookstein's refusal to pay them. But Jack Warner had other skeletons in his closet besides gambling. Explosive secrets that could destroy him and put an end to all his political hopes.
Lenny knew the truth. But Lenny's dead, burning in hell, where he belongs.
The question was, Had he taken his knowledge with him to his watery grave, or had he shared what he knew with his beloved wife? While Grace was safely under lock and key, it didn't matter. But now she was out, running for her life, a loose cannon with nothing to lose. I can't let that bitch destroy me. I won't. Honor ran out to the driveway to meet him. Her eyes were red and swollen. It was obvious she'd been crying.
Oh, Jack! Have you seen the news?
Of course I've seen it. He bundled her indoors. The press could show up at any minute. For God's sake, pull yourself together. Why are you crying?
Honor didn't know. She'd always envied Grace, resented her, hated her even. Even so, her baby sister's conviction troubled her. Grace was no more capable of perpetrating a sophisticated fraud than she was of changing a tire or filling out a tax return. Honor knew that better than anyone. I should have spoken up for her in court, or at least visited her in prison. But I didn't. I did what Jack told me to do. I always do what Jack tells me to do. They said on the news that someone might shoot her, that she's in more danger from the public than she is from the police.
So?
Jack wasn't interested in Grace's problems. He was interested in his own.
Fred's writing me a statement. Until then, I want you and the kids to stay in the house. Don't talk to anyone about Grace. Do you understand?
Honor nodded.
If she tries to contact you, you must inform me immediately. Not the police. Me.
Yes, Jack. He started up the stairs. Honor called after him. Jack? Why do you think she did it?
What do you mean?
I mean, why did she escape? She must have known the danger she was putting herself in, not to mention blowing at any chance of an appeal. It just seems so reckless. So out of character.
Jack Warner shrugged. Maybe she's changed. Prison does change people, you know.
So does politics, thought Honor. She looked at herself in the hall mirror and shivered. She did not recognize the person she'd become.
Escaped. Good God!
Michael Gray had spent the day on his new boat, an anniversary present from Connie. He didn't hear the news till they sat down to dinner that evening.
I know. I wouldn't have thought she had it in her, stowed away in a delivery truck, if you can believe that. So much for maximum security.
Michael looked pained.
Do you think we should... I don't know, try to help her in some way?
Connie's eyes widened.
Help her? Whatever do you mean? How can we possibly help her? More to the point, why should we help her after what she's done?
Michael Gray loved his wife and deferred to her opinions about her own sister. But he'd never felt comfortable about the collective washing of hands and turning of backs that had followed Grace's trial. It hadn't felt right at the time. Now, somehow, it felt less right than ever. So much had changed since that fateful trip to Nantucket a year and a half ago. Back then, Lenny and Grace had had everything. A perfect marriage, a fortune, and he and Connie had nothing. Michael Gray had not forgotten the darkness of those days.
Losing his job at Lehman was like losing a parent. Lehman Brothers had been much more than an employer. It had given Michael his identity, his self-worth. When the company failed, it felt like a death. But Michael had had no time to mourn. He'd been plunged into one crisis after another, watching his savings disappear, then the house. Worst of all was the distance that began to grow between him and Connie. Michael Gray felt he could have borne anything with his wife's support. But with each blow, Connie withdrew from him further. Even the way she looked at him in those days, so disappointed, so disgusted, almost as if what had happened were his fault, as if she blamed him for their suffering. The memory could still cause him to break out in a cold sweat. All that was only 18 months ago, yet it felt like another lifetime. Since then, they'd lived through the Quorum's collapse, Lenny's death, Grace's arrest, the trial, and now this. It was surreal. As Grace's fortunes had declined, so some invisible string seemed to pull Michael and Connie's lives upward, out of the mire, and back into the warmth of the sun. Michael got a job with a boutique advisory firm. The salary wasn't great, but he had equity. More important, he had a reason to get out of bed in the mornings again. You couldn't put a price on that. Connie became less distant and more loving. The disappointment was gone. In its place was the old familiar look of love, that unique combination of trust, lust, and respect that made Michael feel he could move mountains. He loved her so much. She's my strength and my weakness. I'd die for her and I'd kill for her. And she knows it. But the best was yet to come. A few months after Grace began her sentence at Bedford Hills, Connie was called to a meeting by her attorney. Apparently, some distant, elderly relative had left her something in her will. Michael was expecting a few shares or perhaps a nice piece of jewelry. In fact, his wife had been left $15 million. That night, she made love to him with a passion Michael hadn't known in her since before they married. He made a joke. "I guess being a woman of means suits you, honey." Connie beamed. "I guess it does. Let's buy a new house, Mike. This place holds too many painful memories." "Hey, come on. It holds some good memories too, doesn't it? This is where the kids were born. Do you really want to leave?" Connie didn't hesitate. "Yes, I want a new start. For all of us. No looking back." They sold the house. "I can't believe you'd seriously want to help Grace. Where did that spring from?" They were in the formal sitting room of their new townhouse. Connie had gone all out for their first Christmas, decorating the entire house in silver and white. A traditionalist, she refused to take down any of the decorations till Twelfth Night. Michael felt like he was coming home to Santa's grotto. "I don't know. Nowhere specific. We have so much, that's all."
"And Grace doesn't?"
Connie laughed bitterly. Whenever the conversation turned to Grace or Lenny, her anger seemed to re-emerge, like a caged demon unleashed. "That Quorum money is out there somewhere, Mike. The FBI is convinced little Gracie knows where it is. Who are we to say different?"
Mike wanted to say, "Her family, But he didn't. He was too afraid. Connie saw the fear in his eyes and felt her own fear subside. Good. He's not going to force the issue. He loves me too much. Connie was puzzled by her sister's escape. The Grace she knew would never have had the chutzpah to plan anything so daring, never mind see it through and outfox the police into the bargain. Deep down, Connie knew that Grace had nothing to do with stealing the Quorum billions. It's not the money she's after. It's something else. The truth, perhaps. Mike still had no idea about Connie's affair with Lenny Brookstein, nor had he questioned her mysterious inheritance. He's so trusting, just like Grace. Connie wanted it to stay that way. Wrapping her arms around Michael's neck, she whispered, "I want us to be happy, darling, to put the past behind us, don't you?" "Of course I do, my darling." He hugged her back fiercely. "So no more talk about helping Grace. That chapter in our lives is closed forever." Chapter 18. Being in New York again, experiencing the sights and smells, was a homecoming of sorts for Grace. She felt safer in the city. Her new look helped, too. Cropped, chocolate brown hair, dark makeup, baggy, mannish clothes. One of the girls at Bedford had told her that altering one's walk could dramatically change people's perceptions. Grace had spent hours perfecting a longer strided, less girlish gait. It was still unnerving, catching sight of her old face whenever she passed a television or a newsstand. But as the days passed, she grew more confident that the combination of her disguise and the crowded anonymity of the city would protect her. For a while, at least. Her second day in the city, she'd braved a hole-in-the-wall internet cafe and sent a message to the Hotmail address Karen had given her using the specified code 20001120 9LW. Grace hoped this meant, "Please send $2,000 to zip code 11209 in New York in the name of Lizzie Woolley." But she still felt certain that something would go wrong. Was $2,000 too much to ask for, or too little? She realized belatedly she had no idea how much money Karen's friend had or was willing to send her. On the other hand, she didn't want to have to risk doing this every other week, not with half the country's police departments out searching for her. In fact, the pickup had been as smooth as Cora had told her it would be. There was a Western Union outlet in the pharmacy on the corner. A fat, depressed man in his mid-40s had glanced at Grace's ID and, not even bothering to make eye contact, still less examine her features, handed her an envelope full of cash and a printed receipt. "There you go, Miss Woolley. Have a nice day." Grace began to focus less on being captured and more on her impending meeting with Davy Bucola. Davy had been researching the alibis of everyone she and Lenny had invited to Nantucket that fateful weekend. It still didn't seem fully real to Grace, the idea that the Prestons or the Merivilles or even one of her own sisters could have done such a terrible thing, stolen all that money, killed Lenny, caused her to be imprisoned, and gotten away with it. But what other explanation was there? She hoped that when she saw Davy's research in black and white, it would make things clearer. Everything depended on that meeting. Alone in her tiny studio room,
Grace pulled a stack of newspaper clippings out of the desk drawer and arranged them on the bed. There they were. Honor and Jack, Connie and Mike, Andrew and Maria, and, of course, John and Caroline. Among them, those eight faces held the keys to the truth. Next to them, set slightly apart, Grace placed a ninth picture. Detective Mitchell Connors, the man whose job it was to catch her. He was definitely attractive. Grace found herself wondering if he was married, and if he loved his wife as much as she had loved Lenny. He would catch her eventually, of course. Her luck wouldn't hold out forever, but eventually didn't matter to Grace. What mattered was doing what she had set out to do. Closing her eyes, she spoke to Lenny, her words half promise, half prayer.
"I'll do it, my darling. I'll do it for both of us. I'll find out who took you away from me, and I'll make them pay. I promise."
She slept and grew strong.
"More tea, detective? My husband should be back any minute."
Honor Warner was visibly nervous. Mitch noticed the way her hands shook as she lifted the silver tea kettle from its tray. Hot brown liquid spilled all over the white upholstered coffee table.
"No, thank you, Mrs. Warner. It was really you I came to see. Has your sister made any attempt to contact you since her escape?"
"Contact me? No. Absolutely not. If Grace had called, I'd have let the police know immediately." Mitch cocked his head to one side and smiled engagingly.
"Would you? Why is that?"
He was intrigued by this woman. She was Grace Brookstein's sister. At one time, by all accounts, the two women had been very close. They even looked alike. Yet, when Grace fell from grace, Honor Warner had vanished into the ether.
"What do you mean? I don't understand."
"Only that Grace is your sister," Mitch explained. "It would be understandable for you to want to help her. It wouldn't be wrong."
This seemed to throw Honor completely. She looked around her as if searching the room for a means of escape, or perhaps she was scanning it for hidden microphones or cameras. Did she think she was being watched? Eventually, she said, "Grace made a lot of enemies, Detective. She's in greater danger out of prison than she is inside. I'm thinking of her safety." Mitch fought back a smile.
"Like hell you are. You didn't go to the trial."
"No."
"As I understand it, you never visited your sister in Bedford Hills either."
"No."
"Why was that?"
My husband, we felt it were for the best. Jack worked so hard to get where he is today. For voters to associate him with Quorum, well, you understand."
Mitch made no effort to hide his disgust. He understood perfectly. Reading his thoughts, Honor said defensively, "My husband has done a lot of good for his constituents, Detective. A lot of good. Is it right that he should be tainted by Lenny Brookstein's greed? Grace made her own choices. I'm worried about her, but..." She left the sentence hanging. Mitch got to his feet.
"Thank you, Mrs. Warner. I'll see myself out."
It was the same story with Connie Gray.
My younger sister has never learned to take responsibility for her actions, Detective Connors. Grace believes she's entitled to wealth, to beauty, to happiness, to freedom, no matter what the cost to others. So, in answer to your question, no, I don't feel sorry for her, and I certainly haven't heard from her, nor do I expect to.
With friends like Grace Brookstein's, who needed enemies? Talking to Grace's compassionless, embittered sister, Mitch almost felt sorry for the woman whose greed had brought New York to its knees. Connie's anger was like a physical presence in the room, emanating from her body like heat from a radiator. The atmosphere was stifling. Is there anyone else you can think of? Anyone Grace might call or lean on? An old school friend, perhaps, or childhood beau? Connie shook her head regally.
No one. When Grace married Lenny, she got swept up into his world completely.
You sound disapproving.
Lenny and I, let's just say we weren't close. I always thought he and Grace were a mismatch. In any event, there are no old friends. John Merrivale supported Grace for a while, I believe, until Caroline got him to see sense. Poor John.
Why poor John?
Oh, come on, Detective. You've met him. He worshipped Lenny. He was his bag carrier for years.
He was more than that, surely.
John? No, never.
Connie laughed cruelly.
The media paint him as some sort of financial wizard, a key quorum insider. It's farcical. He wasn't even a partner after the best part of 20 years. Lenny used him. So did Grace. Even now he's stuck cleaning up the mess at quorum. No wonder your colleagues at the FBI haven't found that money. Talk about the blind leading the blind.
The press conference was openly hostile. People wanted answers, and Mitch Connors didn't have them. It was almost a week now since Grace Brookstein's dramatic escape from Bedford Hills, and pressure was mounting on Mitch and his team to report some progress. The media seemed to have gotten it into their heads that the NYPD was withholding information. Mitch smiled. If only that were true. The truth was, he had nothing. Grace Brookstein had walked out of that jail and vanished into thin air like David frickin' Blaine. She had contacted no one, not family, not friends. Yesterday, in a move that had been widely and correctly interpreted as desperation, the NYPD put out a $200,000 reward for anyone who provided information leading to Grace's capture. It was a mistake. Within 2 hours, Mitch's team had received over 800 calls. Apparently, Grace Brookstein had been spotted everywhere from New York to Nova Scotia. A couple of leads looked like they might pan out, but both ended up coming to nothing. Mitch felt like a kid trying to catch hold of bubbles, not knowing which way to turn and destroying everything he touched. And to think, he thought this case would be a slam dunk. That's it for today, folks. Thanks. The grumbling press pack dispersed. Mitch crawled back to his office to hide, but it seemed there would be no respite today. Detective Lieutenant Henry Dubray was no oil painting at the best of times. Today, squatting in Mitch's torture chair like a giant toad, he looked even worse than usual. His skin was blotchy and drink-ravaged, and the whites of his eyes were as yellow as sunflowers. The pressure of the Brookstein case was taking its toll on all of them. "Give me some good news, Mitch." "The Knicks won last night?"
"I'm serious."
"So am I. It was a great game. You didn't watch?" Mitch smiled. Dubray didn't. "I'm sorry, boss. I don't know what to tell you. We got nothing."
"We're running out of time, Mitch."
"I know."
Dubray left. There was nothing left to say. Both men knew the reality. If Mitch didn't come up with a solid lead in the next 24 hours, he'd be taken off the case. Demoted, certainly. Maybe even fired.
Mitch tried not to think about Celeste and the expensive private school Helen wanted him to pay for. In that moment, he hated Grace Brookstein. He stared at the whiteboard on the wall of his office. Grace's picture was in the middle. Radiating outward from it like the points of a star were various groups of other photos. Bedford Hills inmates and staff. Grace's family and friends. Quorum connections. Members of the public who'd called in with the most promising leads. How could so many sources lead to nothing? The phone rang.
"Call for you on line one, Detective Connors."
"Who is it?"
"Grace Brookstein."
Mitch gave a mirthless laugh.
"Yeah, thanks, Stella. I'm not in the mood for crank callers."
He hung up. 30 seconds later, the phone rang again.
"Stella, I told you I got enough problems without..."
"Good morning, Detective Connors. This is Grace Brookstein speaking."
Mitch froze. After listening to hours of recordings of Grace's court testimony, he'd have recognized her voice anywhere. He waved frantically to his colleagues in the outer office.
"It's her," he mouthed. "Trace the call."
He made a conscious effort to speak slowly. He couldn't show his excitement. More important, he had to keep her talking.
"Hello, Mrs. Brookstein. What can I do for you?"
"You can listen to me."
The voice was the same as the one in the court recordings, but the tone was different. Harder. More determined.
"I'm listening."
"My husband and I were framed. I never stole any money and neither did Lenny."
Mitch paused, trying to keep her on the line.
"Why are you telling me this, Miss Brookstein? I'm not a jury. Your conviction has nothing to do with me."
"It's Mrs. Brookstein. I'm a widow, detective, not a divorcee."
"You're a fool. You should have never made this call. Just keep talking."
"I'm telling you because you look like a good man, an honest man."
The compliment surprised Mitch.
"Thank you."
"You look like a man who would want to know the truth. Are you?"
"Actually, I'm a man who wants to keep you on the line for the next 10 seconds. 9, 8.
"You know, Mrs. Brookstein, the best thing you could do right now would be to turn yourself in."
6. 5.
Grace laughed.
Please, detective, don't insult my intelligence. I have to go now.
No. Wait. I can help you. If you are innocent, as you say you are, there are legal channels.
Click. The line went dead. Mitch looked hopefully at the guys on the other side of the glass, but the shake of their heads told him what he already knew. 2 more seconds, and we'd have had her. Mitch sank into his chair and put his head in his hands. Immediately, the phone rang again. Mitch leapt on it like a jilted lover, willing it to be her.
Grace?
A man's voice answered.
Detective Connors?
Mitch felt the hope drain out of him like blood from a severed vein.
Speaking.
Detective, my name is John Rodville. I'm the head of admissions at the Putnam Medical Center.
Uh-huh, Mitch said warily. The name meant nothing to him.
We have a patient here, brought in last week with a knife wound to the back. He was in a coma till this morning. We didn't think he'd make it, but he pulled through.
That's terrific, Mr. Rodville. I'm happy for him. Mitch was on the point of hanging up when the man said cheerily,
Yeah, I thought you might be, especially since he just identified his attacker as Grace Brookstein.
Chapter 19. Mitch burst into the intensive care unit.
Detective Connors, I'm here to see Tommy Burns.
He flashed his badge at the staff nurse.
Right this way, detective.
The head of admissions had filled Mitch in on the van driver's story. According to Tommy Burns, he was a freelance gardener who had happened to pick up a hitchhiker a couple of miles outside of Bedford last Tuesday night. The woman went by the name of Lizzie. Tommy drove her about 40 miles north before she suddenly pulled a knife on him, forced him into the woods, stabbed and robbed him, leaving him for dead.
Some local kids found him. They were out hunting. A few more hours and he'd have bled to death for sure.
And he believes this Lizzie who attacked him was actually Grace Brookstein?
He seems certain of it. A few hours after he came to, he asked to have the TV turned on. Brookstein's face came on the news and he went crazy. We had to sedate him. He wants to talk to you, but he's still very weak, so go easy. His wife and kids haven't even seen him yet.
Mitch thought. Wife and kids. The poor bastard's a family man. But, of course, Grace Brookstein didn't care about that. She picked him up, used him to get what she wanted, then left him to die in the woods alone. Painful memories of his dad's murder came flooding back to him. Pete Connors' killer would never be caught. But Grace Brookstein sure as hell would be. Men like Tommy Burns deserved justice. They deserved to be protected. Mitch approached Tommy Burns' bed full of compassion. When he left the hospital 15 minutes later, he found himself wishing Grace Brookstein had finished the job. Tommy Burns was about as likable as a bad case of hemorrhoids. He was also a rotten liar.
Jesus, detective, I already told you. I was the Good Samaritan, okay? I saw a chick in trouble and I did the right thing. 1 minute we were driving along, listening to the radio nice as pie. The next minute, bam, the bitch has a knife to my throat. I never stood a chance.
Mitch wanted to believe him. Badly. Right now, Tommy Burns was the only witness he had. But he didn't believe him. Something about the guy wasn't right.
Let's go back to when you first picked her up, shall we, Mr. Burns? You said she looked like she was in trouble.
She was half-dressed. It was freezing out there, snowing. She had this thin blouse on. You could see right through it.
A half-smile flickered across his face at the memory. Just then, a pretty young nurse came in to refill the water pitcher. Mitch Connors watched Tommy Burns follow her lustfully with his eyes as she turned and left the room. A light went on in Mitch's brain. You didn't think to ask her why she was dressed like that on a freezing winter's night?
No. Why should I? None of my business.
I suppose not. Still, out of curiosity...
I'm not a curious person.
Yes, I can see that.
Tommy Burns's eyes narrowed. Something about Mitch's tone gave him the feeling he was being mocked.
What do you mean by that?
I don't mean anything by it. I'm simply agreeing with you that you lack curiosity. For example, you don't seem to have asked yourself why, after going to all the trouble of trying to murder you, this woman didn't finish the job.
Tommy Burns became agitated.
Hey, now, don't you go giving me no this woman bullshit. It was Grace Brookstein. I saw her on the TV, plain as day. You catch her, I'll be wanting that $200,000 reward.
Fine, said Mitch. Let's say it was Grace Brookstein who attacked you.
It was.
If it were me, I'd still be asking myself that question. Why did she let me live? Why didn't she finish the job? But then again, you see, I am a curious person. We detectives usually are.
Tommy considered this.
I guess she thought she had. Finished the job, I mean. We were out in the middle of nowhere, probably figured I'd die slow.
Mitch pounced.
Really? Why do you think she would want you to die slowly? Excuse me?
According to you, her motive was theft. She needed a ride and she needed money. That being the case, I could understand her wanting you dead. She wouldn't want witnesses, right?
Right.
But what reason would she have to make you suffer? To prolong your agony?
What reason? Hell, I don't know. She's a woman, ain't she? They're all fucked up bitches.
Mitch nodded slowly.
You're right. I mean, if a man had done this, he'd have taken the van, right?
Huh?
Tommy Burns looked well and truly confused.
Once he'd gotten rid of you, he could have used the vehicle to get another 40, 50, 100 miles away from the crime scene before he dumped it somewhere. That'd be the smart thing to do, wouldn't it?
I guess it would.
But women aren't as smart as us, are they?
Damn right they ain't.
Mitch leaned forward conspiratorially.
We both know what women are good for, don't we, Tommy? And it isn't their powers of reasoning.
Tommy smiled stupidly. Now the cop was talking his language.
Tell me, Tommy, do you regularly pick up hitchhikers?
Sometimes.
Are many of them as attractive as Grace Brookstein?
No, sir, not many.
Or as good in the sack?
No, sir.
Tommy Burns grinned.
She was something else!
It was a full 5 seconds before he realized his mistake. The smile wilted.
Hey now, don't you go putting words in my mouth. I'm the victim here, he stammered. I'm the goddamn victim!
It was late by the time Mitch got home that night, if you could call the shitty 2-bedroom rental that was all he could afford since Helen left him home. Helen got everything when they split. Celeste, the house, even the dog Snoopy. My dog. Mitch could understand the things that drove men to hate women. Men like Tommy Burns. It would be easy to slip down that path. He had to guard against it himself sometimes. It had been quite a day. The press conference, a phone call from Grace Brookstein herself, and finally Tommy Burns. Burns was Mitch's first real concrete lead. Mitch knew he ought to feel elated. Instead, he felt uneasy. After Tommy Burns' slip of the tongue this afternoon, they'd come to an understanding. Mitch would look no further into a possible sexual assault of Grace Brookstein. In return, Tommy would forget about the $200,000 reward and would tell Mitch everything he could remember from that night. Grace's clothing, her demeanor, anything at all she might have said or done that could shed light on her plans. Tommy's van had been sent to forensics. When Mitch spoke to them a few hours ago, they'd been hopeful. It should provide a treasure trove of new evidence. So why do I feel like crap? Mitch had walked into that hospital this afternoon full of righteous rage and loathing. Grace Brookstein was a criminal, a heartless thief, and would-be killer who had violently attacked an innocent family man. Except that if Tommy Burns was an innocent family man, Mitch Connors was Big Bird. The email finally came through after midnight. Mitch had run a check on Tommy Burns' record. Sure enough, he had a string of sexual assault convictions stretching back almost 20 years. 2 rape charges had been thrown out for lack of evidence. So much for the Good Samaritan. Something had happened in that van. Burns was a sexual predator, and Grace had defended herself. In this case, at least, that made her the victim. Mitch suddenly realized, I don't want her to be the victim. I want her to be the bad guy. Usually, he was unequivocal about his cases and the people he brought to justice. To Mitch, they were all paler versions of whoever had killed his father. Bad men, men who deserved to be brought down. But already, this case felt different. Part of him hated Grace for her crimes. Her greed and lack of remorse were well documented. But another part of him pitied her. Pitied her for having to deal with the likes of Tommy Burns. Pitied her for having that pair of heartless vultures for sisters. Mitch closed his eyes and tried to imagine how Grace Brookstein must have felt in Burns' van. Alone, on the run, already desperate, and the first man she trusted turned out to be a psychotic pervert. Burns wasn't a big guy, but he was strong, and presumably determined. Grace must have shown great courage to fight him off like that. What would her next move have been? She wouldn't hitch another ride. Not if Burns had just raped her. She'd take off on foot, which means she couldn't have gotten far that night. A couple of